Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Comedian Leanne Lord was getting coffee.
Okay, let me set the scene. I'm at the Dunkin' Donuts drive-thru.
Good morning, how can I help you?
She's ordering her usual, medium, milk and sugar.
Medium hot coffee and milk and sugar?
Her total, $2.16. She pulls up to the window. The cashier is young. He looks like a teenager.
I hand the kid $3, and as he's making change, I find 20 cents and try to give it to him. He looks at me in a panic. My receipt already in his hand, he shakes his head and says, "No, it's too late." I said, "No, no it isn't." He says, "Okay," and hands me 75 cents. What?
Now Leanne is feeling a little panicked.
Not because he gave me the wrong change, but because he knew it was wrong and had no idea how to fix it. None. Like, I could see it in his face.
Leanne hated math as a kid, so she gets it, and she really wants to help this guy out. She wants to show him, you can do this.
Let's do the math together. It's $2.16. I gave you $3, then 20 cents. Now you give me back $1. He reached into the register and gave me $1. And now 4 cents. Again, he complied. And I said, "You know I'm not trying to cheat you, right?" He nodded, but I'm not sure he really understood. And I wanted him to. I didn't just want my correct change. I wanted him to know what my correct change was supposed to be.
Leanne doesn't think her quick math lesson really did the trick for this kid, but...
maybe all I did or hope I did was give math a friendly face. Maybe next time the kid will know what the correct change is, or... he'll at least want to know. I mean, it's not magic. It's math.
But for lots of us, it might as well be magic. All those numbers, equations, fractions. Math can become a barrier. It can prevent us from succeeding in school, from pursuing a major we really like. But it goes beyond that. Not being able to do basic math can impact so many parts of our lives. Our health, the ability to stay afloat financially or to buy a home. On today's show, math, how we learn it, why so many of us fear it, and how we can get better at it. Our first story is about how we teach math, what works and what doesn't. American kids lag behind the rest of the world in math. Lots of kids leave school not even knowing the basics. Is that because we're not teaching it well? Teresa Franklin thinks so. She sent us an email saying that in high school, she got decent grades in math. Algebra 1, 2, trigonometry. The problem was, she had no idea what she was doing.
I should have failed. Why was I given good grades?
She thinks maybe her teachers felt like she was a hopeless case, or they felt sorry for her. So she passed and passed. But then in college, her math problems became a real issue. She failed every math class she took, but she really wanted to become a scientist. Finally, she enrolled in an absolute beginner's math class.
It was exhilarating to finally get algebra. I had been missing basic information that I needed to progress. Information that I learned in this beginner's workbook-based class.
Teresa first got a degree in chemistry. Now she is a neuroscientist. It all worked out for her, but math could have derailed her dreams. Lots of teachers are really passionate about making sure kids understand math early on, and they're looking for ways to teach this subject better. Alan Yu reports.
One boy in Lafayette, Indiana, recently thought his struggle with math was an emergency. He called 911.
911. Hi, can you hear me?
He explained he had a bad day at school and had tons of homework.
What subjects do you have homework in?
Math, and it's so hard.
So what are you learning in math? What's so difficult?
Fractions.
Oh, okay.
The operator helped him do 3 over 4 plus 1 over 4.
Okay. I'm sorry for calling you, but
no,
I really need help.
You're fine. We're always here to help.
Okay. Thank you.
What's, yeah.
Homework is not one of the emergencies the police department trains for, but the dispatcher had a little extra time, so she helped the boy out and brightened his day. First responders probably aren't the best people to call with a math crisis, but education researchers agree math is a national problem. There's lots of math anxiety, and students sometimes hate math for the rest of their lives. For this story, we're going to cover two approaches that people are trying out to make learning math better for kids. Caroline Ebby teaches aspiring math teachers at the University of Pennsylvania. She'll explain the first way educators are addressing the problem. She says the issue is that in the US, people learn math as a set of rules to follow. Let's stick with fractions.
Take the problem 1/2 divided by 1/3. Okay, so most of our students would say, yeah, I know how to do that. I think you do something like you multiply by the reciprocal, like they remember a rule.
Okay, hang in there. We know fractions can stress people out.
So they would say 1/2 times the reciprocal, which would be 3/2, and they could get the answer as 3/2, and then simplify that to be 1.5. So the students might know that procedure. We might say to them in class, okay, we want you to explain why 1/2 divided by 1/3 is 1.5. And they have no idea. All they know is this procedure that actually made no sense to them.
And these somewhat clueless students are future math teachers. So Caroline and a lot of educators around the country are teaching math differently. They want students to know how calculations work, to know what they're doing when they divide 1/2 by 1/3. Students have to show and explain their work, even for math problems that seem simple. You can see this in action at William M. Meredith Elementary School, a public school in Philadelphia.
Good afternoon, mathematicians.
Good afternoon, Miss Severino.
Everyone in this second grade classroom was doing this problem, 123 minus 48. And their teacher wants to make sure they know not just how to get the answer, but understand the process of getting there. Maybe in your head, you put 123 on top of 48 and drew a horizontal line.
So I carried the 1 to the 3 and then 13.
Then you calculate the difference. In Miss Severino's class, the students are learning a second process to get to the same answer, an approach where you have to show your work even more.
Okay, so I used a number line, and so I started at 48 because that's what you're subtracting from 123. So I hopped 2 to 50, 50 to 100, 20 to 120, and 3 to 123. And then I added 2 plus 50 plus 20 plus 3, and I got the answer of 75.
Okay, if this sounds too complicated, here is what the student did. She realized when you subtract two numbers, you find the distance between them. So you could really just start from 48 and count up until you hit 123. Her teacher, Kate Severino, says this strategy is simple enough that one kid was able to explain it to the whole class.
Everybody in the room kind of stopped and was like, oh, that's something that's really cool. That was a huge shift for me because a lot of times as a math teacher, when you ask a kid how they solved a problem and they say, oh, I did it in my head, they have absolutely no idea how to explain that because they're like, oh, the answer just popped into my head. But that never happens. We know that doesn't happen. There's always a process.
Kate wants the kids to know how the strategies work and have them pick whichever process works for them. But Angela McIver saw her daughter do this in elementary school, and she got frustrated that her daughter has to explain so much just for a simple math problem.
They teach strategies for solving problems that are highly inefficient.
Angela used to be a middle school math teacher, but now she has a business running a math club. She says all this showing your work is an unnecessary burden for younger kids.
So a lot of kids come into elementary school with some level of automaticity, things that they know, like they know that 7 plus 4 is 11. But in the lower grades, a lot of time is spent deconstructing 7 plus 4, and kids have to write how they explain how they learned it, explain how they know that they can do 7 plus 3 is 10 and then add 1 and make 11. So it undoes skills that we're trying to build in kids. So that's one of the things.
Angela says if we make kids show their work for simple math problems, that just bogs down their thought process when they should be getting fast and good at easy problems as a foundation for harder ones.
There's not enough repetition and reinforcement for mastery. So a lot of content is handled in the lower grades, in the elementary grades, and kids don't master any of it.
So Angela has a second fix for our national math crisis. Part of her solution involves lots of memorization. At her business, Trapezium Math Club, at the start of this session, the students sit in a circle on the floor with one student in the middle. They do something called skip counting. That's counting up and then back down by multiples. It's like memorizing and reading back the results of times tables. This kid had to count up and down by 6 in under 30 seconds.
6, 12, 18, 24, 30, 6.
It's like muscle memory to do simple calculations very quickly.
54, 48, 50. Stop you there at
48. So say you need 50 eggs for a huge bake sale, but at the grocery store, they only have cartons of 6. The kid could skip count up to 48, and then know quickly he'd have to buy 9 six-packs to get 50 eggs. And Angela says her approach is more than just counting fast. She says this fluency that comes from repetition and memorization creates a mental map for numbers. That helps when students move on to more difficult concepts like fractions and algebra. And in this approach, it's no small thing that teachers try to make it fun.
When you add my digits, you get 5. When you multiply my digits, you get 6. I am an odd number. Who am I, Lily?
23. Okay.
The kids learn math tricks and play games, and they are eager to do math. So there are these two different ways of teaching math. One, a big emphasis on showing your work. The second, a big emphasis on speed and being comfortable with numbers. Which approach children learn at school can vary a lot, depending on whether they go to public school, private school, and where they live in the US. Here's something that's probably not going to change anytime soon. Eventually, your kid's going to ask you for help when they think they have a math emergency. That's what Dash from the movie Incredibles 2 did.
That's not the way you're supposed to do it, Dad. They want us to do it this
way. I don't
know
that way. Why would they change math? Math is math.
It's okay,
math,
Dad.
Is math.
I'll just wait for Mom to get back.
What? Well, she won't understand it any better than I do.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. Keeping kids engaged in the process is a big part of the equation in teaching math. Nicole Whistler is a middle school teacher on Orcas Island off the coast of Bellingham in Washington State. Nicole teaches sixth graders and says at that age, a lot of them are making up their minds about math. Nicole sent us this audio postcard from the classroom.
Teaching sixth grade feels so fragile and urgent. My students are constantly trying to categorize or label each other and themselves. Many of them are starting to call themselves either smart or dumb, particularly when it comes to math. Even though in reality they're all brilliant and creative and quick, I worry that once a kid puts themselves in one of these boxes, it'll be nearly impossible to get them out.
Okay, today I would just want to go around the room and how do you feel about yourself as a mathematician, or as a math person, or not?
I don't like math.
What don't you like about math, or why don't you like math?
I don't understand it, so I'm really bad at it.
I feel like I'm kind of in the middle. There's some things, like division is kind of hard for me, but multiplication, addition, subtraction, those are kind of my strengths.
Well, I really like math. Like last year, when school was over, and it was the summer, I asked my teacher if I could have a big packet of math. And I didn't get one, but it's really fun.
I felt like that I'm getting dumber and dumber doing math instead of smart.
What makes you feel like you're getting dumber and dumber?
All the words I don't know, and that the double number lines and all that stuff that I don't know how to do, which makes me feel like really dumb.
I like doing math, but sometimes I feel like in class we do stuff that's like pointless, that I never use or whatever.
I don't want to talk about math because math is like probably like an hour of taken away from my day where I have to just learn something that's not really going to be that useful.
I feel like to get into some colleges, like having a good math expertise would be great, but in general, I mean, math can help with anything. Just even seeing what discount you get in a store, going all the way up to, like, engineering and stuff.
But does anyone, like, I'm not going to use math. I'm going to use a calculator.
Oh, heck yeah.
Yeah. Kind of. Remy?
Or Siri.
or maybe Alexa.
Yeah. Savoya and Cynthia? Yeah.
If I go to the, like, store and I have to use math, and I'll just, like, quit and leave it alone and just get random stuff, so...
No bargains for you. Just, yeah. I don't care what it costs. I'm going to buy it because I don't want to do the math.
I'm out.
Yeah.
Those were sixth grade students in Nicole Whistler's classroom on Orcas Island, Washington State. We're talking about math today, how we learn it, why we need it. For Oscar Fernandez, math is the key to all kinds of things. He's a math professor at Wellesley College in Massachusetts, and he says you can crunch numbers for better sleep, a healthier diet, or let's say you want to divide something fairly between two people, like a pot of money or cookies. Maybe one person absolutely loves these cookies, but the other person is really hungry and didn't have breakfast.
And they want to find an algorithm or a set of rules so that they can divide this thing fairly. People don't walk away, neither party walks away just completely angry or something.
Oscar has a website. It's called Surrounded by Math, and he used an algorithm developed by mathematician John Nash, a Nobel Prize winner. John Nash wrote about this algorithm in a famous article called The Bargaining Problem. So Oscar used it to create an online questionnaire for his website.
And then I worked out the formulas so that you can plug in information about, you know, how unhappy would you be if no agreement can be reached? How happy would you be if you got all of the thing? How happy would you be if you got half of the thing? So you plug in your quantities and the math will give you at least a starting point, you know, and then you can start from there and talk to your partner or talk to your friend and start as a basis of conversation.
It sounds more like something a psychologist would solve, right? So it might seem foreign to people to say, hey, we have $5,000 that we need to divvy up. So let's do this with a mathematical formula.
Oftentimes we don't think of math as something that we can apply to a problem in the real world. But once you do that, you're going to get much more insights.
To go back to this example of, let's say we have $5,000 and two people. I mean, isn't the simplest, fairest thing to just say we each take half?
It doesn't always work that way because half is the most equal distribution of the money, but it's not the most equitable. So perhaps of the 5,000, I would really, really, really appreciate if you gave me 3,000 because $3,000 is more money than I have ever had in my entire life. So there might be some, you know, variety of reasons for which one person might prefer to have more than half. And then the question is, okay, what is fair? What is just? What is equitable?
And in this particular question, you are asking people to put a number on their feelings. How happy are you from 1 to 10? How unhappy are you? So I could imagine just putting a number on it and then plugging those numbers into an equation could also just take some of the emotional stress out of it.
For sure. And that's one of the nice things about that particular application. In order for you to use the formulas, you have to quantify certain things that are important in the decision-making process that you might not have otherwise thought to quantify. Just bringing math into the setting really changes how you think about problem solving and can really help you start a dialogue and help you focus on what things are really, you know, what really matters.
Oscar Fernandez is the author of The Calculus of Happiness. We're talking about math, how we learn it, why we need it, and how we can get better at it. And that part, getting better at it, can't be fixed by trying harder for some people. Liz Tung has more.
Whitney Donaldson was always bad at math. But as she got older, she and her parents noticed other problems, ones that went way beyond just memorizing her times tables.
I had trouble reading around clock face. I had trouble remembering numbers, even if I had looked at them over and over, remembering equations. I transpose numbers a lot. So instead of like 85, I might write 58 or something like that.
It was as if the part of her brain that dealt with any kind of mathematical thinking, numbers, patterns, spatial reasoning, was asleep at the wheel.
I got lost really easily. I didn't have good, like, I guess, depth perception almost. Like, I would knock over milk and stuff at the table a lot.
Whitney's mom was a teacher, and she started to suspect that Whitney might have a learning disability. So in fourth grade, she got Whitney tested. She was pretty much off the charts good when it came to reading and verbal. As for math?
Low, like fifth percentile type thing. So, and so they diagnosed me with dyscalculia.
In case you didn't catch that, Whitney says she was diagnosed with dyscalculia or dyscalculia.
People vary in the way they say it. I say developmental dyscalculia, but I've heard many different pronunciations.
That's psychology researcher Daniel Ansari. He heads the Numerical Cognition Laboratory at the University of Western Ontario in Canada. He uses brain images to study the neurobiology of how mathematical thinking works, or in the case of kids with dyscalculia, doesn't work.
Many more of your listeners will probably know or have heard of developmental dyslexia, which is a specific difficulty in the domain of reading. So it's sort of the analogous thing in the domain of math learning, and that's what we call developmental dyscalculia.
Dyscalculia is similar to dyslexia, but it seems to affect different processes. For instance, instead of making it hard to connect sounds with written words, people with dyscalculia might have trouble with math concepts.
Children with developmental dyscalculia have difficulties in linking symbols such as the Arabic numeral 5 to the concept of the quantity of 5 items.
They might have trouble figuring out which of two numbers is bigger, or counting out change in their hands. How many coins make up what number? Stuff like this can make people think there's something wrong with them. Daniel's heard from people all over the world about how it's affected them.
And those stories were devastating. You know, they just thought that something was fundamentally wrong with them, that they were individuals who were never going to make it in life.
Which is why Whitney says, for her, getting that diagnosis was a major relief.
It was hugely helpful for a number of reasons. One is that I didn't feel stupid anymore because I was finally told that this thing that was so hard for me wasn't my fault.
Whitney's 29 now, and she says thanks to time and a lot of practice, she's learned how to do most of the things she couldn't as a kid, like read analog clocks or calculate the tip at a restaurant. Sometimes she says she just needs a little extra time.
It was just a postcard that my mom had and she gave to me. I taped it to the front of my math notebook, but it was from Jack Handy on Saturday Night Live.
Instead of having answers on a math test, they should just call them impressions. And if you got a different impression, so what? Can't we all be brothers?
That story was reported by Liz Tung. Math impacts so many different aspects of our lives. For example, our finances. Let's say you need some money for a car, for college, to buy a home, to fix your heater, and you go to your bank to figure out what your options are, and it quickly starts to sound like gibberish.
We can offer you a great deal here with this special interest rate loan.
With your credit rating right now?
The best I can do for you is...
It's a balloon mortgage.
So a large amount of the principal will be paid off.
One lump sum at the end of the loan period.
At the end,
this is a 15-year
loan. So you tell me if you want to lock this in right now. The interest rate is at a 3.875.
So you tell me if you want to lock this in right now.
Ready to sign?
Ready to sign?
Ready to sign?
And you're thinking, what on earth are they talking about?
What does interest on a loan mean? What happens with compound interest? What is a balloon payment?
That last voice you heard is Nan Morrison. She heads the Council for Economic Education.
All of these things are just language. It's like showing up in a foreign country and not even knowing how to ask directions.
Nan's organization works to increase financial literacy, meaning make sure that people understand money, budgets, loans, percentages, to make solid decisions about their finances. Our show is about math, so how does math fit into all of this?
Well, I'm a math major, so you're singing my song. You really need math to run the numbers. So being able to add, subtract, multiply, and divide by 12 if you're doing a budget are all really important things.
Something that I always think about with finances is being able to figure out percentages.
Percentages are really important because one of the most important concepts of personal finance is compound interest. So if I put $100 away today and it earns 10% a year from now, I'm going to have $110. Then the following year, I'm earning still 10%, but now it's going to be on $110 instead of $100. So this idea of compound interest, interest on interest, is a very important concept of savings.
Where do math teachers come into this? I remember math problems being about trains coming in from somewhere and going at a certain speed or elevators making stops. Like, those are the math problems I remember.
Yes, I love that you raised the train one, because that's the example that we teach in algebra or pre-algebra, right when kids are really beginning to do more complicated problem solving. And I can tell you that when I got out of graduate school, I had a lot of loans. And when I was sitting on the train going to Washington for a meeting, I never, ever, ever calculated how fast that other train was coming toward me. Never. But every month, I was calculating what was happening with my student loans and did I have enough money to make an extra payment. So I'm a big proponent of getting more financial problems into the math curriculum. Not Amtrak, but bank accounts.
Could you give me an example of what a simple math problem would be that involves bank accounts, interest, budgets? I don't know.
Yeah, so we actually have a classroom activity for second and third graders that uses jelly beans to have students understand the concept of compound interest. And every day they get interest on the amount of jelly beans that they still have. And if they withdraw jelly beans, i.e. they eat them, then the amount of interest they get is obviously smaller because the principal that's there is smaller. And at the end of a week of this activity, the kids who didn't eat their jelly beans and saved have a lot more jelly beans than the kids who didn't. And they start to see the reality of the power of compound interest. Now, you could play with a lot of numbers on a page, but there's nothing more powerful than seeing all those jelly beans add up.
With older students, Nan says you can work through paychecks and figure out taxes, talk budgets and savings. Teaching finances to kids is required in less than half of all states in the U.S. So Nan says lots of kids don't learn about this in school at all. What are some of the impacts of not being financially literate? How does that affect people's lives?
It's not good. A very well-respected researcher about a year ago published a paper that said more than one-third of the financial inequality in the U.S. could be accounted for by differences in financial literacy. And I thought, wow, the problem is also worse based on socioeconomic and gender lines.
For example, people with lower incomes tend to use banks less, and instead they rely on expensive services like check cashing. Or people borrow money from retirement plans, and there are penalties for that. So what about learning about money at home? I think sometimes parents are perhaps reluctant to discuss money with their kids or their budget or, God forbid, how much they make or how much the mortgage is.
Yeah, so that's a great question. And it's super surprising to me when I hear parents say how concerned they were about raising the subject with their kids. Parents should just talk about stuff at the dinner table. If they're about to buy a new car or refrigerator, talk to their kids about how they're making the decision, because the process of making those decisions and the choices and trade-offs are important for the kids to hear about.
Nan Morrison heads the Council for Economic Education. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about math, how we learn it, and why it's so important. And guess what? Not knowing math could be bad for your health. Julian Harris has more.
Quick, what's 154 divided by 7? No cheating. Still thinking? The answer is 22. For some people, a fairly straightforward math problem like that makes the brain short circuit. Remember that show, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader?
Welcome to the show that gives grown-ups the chance to prove that they are actually smarter than a fifth grader. All right, let's meet...
Lots of us are not smarter, at least when it comes to math. Roughly 29% of people in the U.S. can't do much math beyond adding and subtracting. So, maybe that's you. What's the big deal? You swore off math after failing that stats class in college... Besides, you always have your phone nearby anyway. But if you have certain health conditions, struggling with math can make it difficult for you to manage your illness. Meet Samantha Wilner. She told us she's terrible at math.
I won't say terrible at math. It just never came naturally and was not something I ever liked doing. But, you know, if your life depended on doing math, you would do the math.
For her, life kind of does depend on math. Samantha has type 1 diabetes, so she has to do math before she eats. Tonight's dinner is a chef's salad.
Lettuce, cold cuts, eggs.
She's counting the carbs in her meal.
The lettuce is pretty negligible. If anything, I would say like 4 carbs or something like that. And the meat is all protein.
She quickly calculates that this meal probably has about 8 grams of carbs. Samantha and others with diabetes need to get the math right to figure out how much insulin they'll need to balance out blood sugar. Psychologist Ellen Peters says knowing math can really matter to your health.
One person who told me, I miscalculated how long a prescription medication would last. I ran out of pills and I ended up very ill.
Ellen studies enumeracy. That's basically illiteracy, but for math. She says getting tripped up by math can mean people don't understand their health risks or their chances of getting better.
So another person told me I'd been diagnosed with cancer. The test result numbers were very confusing and I felt scared. And these particular people are smart and educated people. The first one that I mentioned had a master's degree. The second one actually had a PhD.
Ellen says not being able to do math has nothing to do with being smart. Lots of people struggle with it.
That's Julian Harris. We're talking about math, why we need it, why so many people fear it, and how we can learn it better. Girls are less likely than boys to take more advanced math classes. And that's a big deal because we reward people who are good at math in all kinds of ways. We use the SAT and GRE, which both have math sections, to decide who gets into which college. We pay people in mathy jobs more than other people. So what's holding girls back? We asked Tanya Ott to look into it.
I have always been good at math. Back in third grade, my school plucked me out of my regular class and put me and 2 other advanced students in a special math class, just the 3 of us and a teacher, working through problems that probably would have freaked out the rest of the third graders. That fast track continued through middle and high school. I didn't love math more than any other subject, but I was probably a feminist by age 5, and being good at math challenged a stereotype, and I loved that. In college, I majored in communications, but I minored in math, and I took statistics and engineering calculus. It wasn't until I got out of college that it really sunk in that talking about math brings up all kinds of emotions for people, but especially women. My mother-in-law swears she is terrible at math, but let me tell you, she can figure out 40% off a department store shirt in record time. I also talked with Annika Klein. She says her battle with math began in elementary school.
I remember we were learning long division and we had gone beyond the multiplication tables, which I also hated, and kind of were getting into this more complicated math.
It was tough, really tough. And she was lost.
It's just mortifying as a little kid when your teacher is like, okay, well, the solution here is for you to not have recess and for this other kid in the class to also not have recess. And he's going to stay in and show you how to do this. And I felt really bad for him and for myself. I remember like kind of just wanted to pretend like I understood what he was saying and so that we could move on and not have to do this again.
From that point on, her strategy was to fake it or avoid math altogether. That seems to happen to a lot of women. They're much less likely to enroll in math-heavy coursework in college and pursue math-heavy careers like engineering and computer science. And the reason? It may have more to do with socialization than innate ability. There's this really large nationwide study that tracked more than 20,000 kids who started kindergarten in 1998. They gave the kids an initial test of their mathematical ability and found that there was basically no difference in math performance for most boys and girls. The researchers retested the kids regularly over the next few years and found that by third grade, boys generally were outperforming girls. The difference was small, but it was there. I was really curious about this, so I called a guy who's spent a lot of time interpreting the data that came out of that big study. Joseph Simpian studies equity in education policy at New York University. He told me in addition to testing students, the researchers also asked the teachers to rate each student's math skills.
how good is Johnny at adding two-digit numbers to three-digit numbers? And then the teacher would say, you know, beginning proficiency.
So they had not only the student's actual performance on the math tests, but also the teacher's ratings.
When you do that, and you have these equally performing, equally engaged, and equally well-behaved boys and girls, the teacher then says, the boy is better at math.
Implicit bias may be to blame.
All right, so we are going to be talking about constructions. How many of you know what constructions?
Martha Makowski teaches future teachers at the University of Alabama. Today, they're learning how to use a compass to measure line segments.
Okay, did anybody have a different solution? Yeah.
I don't think it's right. I copied the original and then I just... Extended.
Before Martha was a teacher, she was a student. And for her, literature was a real struggle.
I don't know what, you know, the meaning of the Odyssey is. Like, isn't it just a story about this guy who goes on this journey? And I can tell you all about...
Martha says math was comforting because it was really black and white. You followed the steps and you got the right answers. But in grad school, Martha realized it's not actually that simple. You have to be okay with getting the wrong answer over and over again.
Some research suggests that boys are better risk takers in general. Better being sort of the operative word, because is it good if you're more willing to throw yourself out of an airplane? but when it comes to mathematics, this idea of like mathematical risk taking and like being okay with being wrong, and like it feels like boys are more likely to go, oh, I have the right answer, even if they, and be sure that it's the right answer, even if they don't have like a reason, and girls being a little more socialized to only go, oh, I have the right answer, if they can, you know that they've done it.
She wants to flip the script, to make the struggle, the failure, the goal. She says by rewarding grit and stick-to-itness, teachers could help demystify math. Remember Annika Klein, the woman who had to skip recess to learn long division? She ended up in a job where she was forced to do math. She got a job at a radio station in Arizona, producing a talk show.
Hey guys, I want to do like a roller coaster fade with this. That's what I'm going to call it.
Producers are kind of like the air traffic controllers in a studio.
Down and cue the back notes, and then up again.
Part of Annika's job is subtracting the amount of time left in a taped interview from the time on the actual clock, while instructing an engineer when to do things and whispering in the host's ear. All in real time while the show is live on the air.
30 seconds suddenly like flies by and you're just like, oh my gosh, wait, I have to do that in that amount of time? Like, and time suddenly becomes like really stretchy, like an accordion, and it goes in and out and it just doesn't feel real anymore because your heart is beating.
At first, she borrowed a colleague's time calculator. But after a while, she got so good at it, she could figure time on the fly.
And then I noticed, like, I started doing it in the break room. Like, I would heat up my lunch, and then the microwave would have, like, a minute 35 left, and I would be like, okay, so we're going to be out of this segment at this time. And then I would be like, wait, I'm doing it. I'm doing it in my head right now.
That story was reported by Tanya Ott. We're talking about math, how knowing it or not knowing it affects us and our lives. One of my coworkers told me he uses math to make money.
I enjoy playing craps. I play my own system that I've created. It's a little complicated when you have two different betting systems going at one time, so you really have to pay attention.
He says it works. Could math make all of us winners? I talked with mathematician Adam Kucharski. He's the author of The Perfect Bet, How Science and Math Are Taking the Luck Out of Gambling. Adam, I am not a gambler at all, and I also don't go to casinos very often just because usually it ends up just being a place where I quickly spend $100 and then... And then I go home. So if I want to go to the casino and I want to play one game and I want to sort of figure out what my odds are, what do I need to know?
So I think one of the most fundamental things to know in a casino is how much edge the casino has over you. I think that can be very useful to know what your starting point is and then how much effort you've got to make to actually break even or, in an ideal world, make some money.
Adam says math won't change your luck with some games, like slot machines. They are always a bad deal for players, but it can help you gamble smarter.
One of the fundamental ideas in gambling that first emerged a few hundred years ago is this idea of what's known as expected value. So in other words, if you were to play this game repeatedly, on average, how much would you lose or gain? Ideally, you want a situation where your expected value is positive. You want to be making money over time rather than losing it. And a lot of the, in fact, early maths of probability and sort of early statistics emerged basically because gamblers wanted to know how favorable or unfavorable these games were.
Let's say I want to increase my chances at winning in blackjack. That's something I've played a few times. The idea of the game is straightforward. You have to get as close to 21 without going over to beat the dealer. And the dealer has to get to at least 17. Adam says with blackjack,
the casino will have about a 6% edge over the player. So in other words, if you go and bet $100, on average, you'd expect to lose about $6.
So how come the dealer has so much better of a chance?
In blackjack, the dealer's main edge comes from the fact that the player has to go first. So if you're a player and you draw too many cards and go over 21, you go bust. And so the dealer in that case then doesn't have to play. So it's one of these games where the person who goes first has a big disadvantage.
But Adam says there is a clue on the table that can help me improve my odds.
One of the dealer's cards is face up. Mm-hmm. So you know what one of the cards the dealer has, but you don't know the other one. And if you take this into account when you're betting or when you're choosing how many cards to draw or whether you want to stick on a certain number, that can actually increase your odds. These mathematicians realized that you can actually reduce that house edge to about 0.2%.
Wow.
So the house still has an advantage, it's much closer to even than this kind of 6% that they were taking off you before.
Give me an example. So let's say the dealer has what?
Let's say the dealer has a 6. So the dealer has to follow this fixed rule that they draw up to 17 and stick otherwise. A 6 is a bit of a problematic card because there's a lot of ways the dealer's going to draw too many cards. So for example, say they've got a 6 and their other cards are 10. That gives them 16. So they have to draw another card in that situation. And it really gives them a risk of going bust. And what it means as a player is that, say you only have 14 on your initial go. That doesn't seem great, but actually, because it's so likely that the dealer will go bust, you can get away with sticking on that lower number. In contrast, if the dealer had something like a 10, that puts them in a pretty strong situation. So as a player, you're going to want to take more risks. And actually, you're only going to want to stick when you get to a much higher number.
All right, so to recap, if I see that the dealer has a 6 or below, I can afford to take less risk and stop taking cards even if I only have 14. But if the dealer has a 7 or up, I need to try to get closer to 21.
So that very simple insight can actually dramatically increase your odds when you're playing the game.
I decided to try my luck, and I went to the Sugar House Casino in Philadelphia. I got $20 worth of chips. I found a blackjack table. I played 3 games, betting $10 on each hand.
Good luck to you.
Thank you. Oh my God, I have no idea what I'm doing.
You have to count the cards.
Oh, okay.
There you go.
I feel nervous. I get nervous in casinos because I'm mostly, not because I just put $10 on the table, just because I have no idea what I'm doing. But get this, I won the first game sticking to Adam's strategy. The dealer's face-up card was a lower number, yeah, yeah. So I took less risk and it paid off.
22, you won.
Woo! Got so fast, oh my God. Can we go a little slower? I'm a little slow, so. The second hand, the dealer started with a 10, so I had to take more risk, and I went bust. I lost. All right, I'm going to do one more. There we go. 9, and he has a 3. The dealer had a 3 on the table, so I stuck with my 15. Done. See? It worked. It worked. All right. I won $10 total. I'm going to turn this into real money. Thank you. So, 3 games, I won twice. Not bad. Turn $20 into $30. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about math. All right, remember learning the multiplication tables in school? My least favorite to this day are the 7s and 8s, or the absolute worst, ask me what 7 times 8 is. Alex Stern had no interest in learning these multiplication tables in school. None. When it came time to study, she would just sit at her desk.
bend paper clips, or I'd sit there and I'd like doodle. Like, I would do anything but that.
And she has one man to thank for the fact that she knows what 7 times 8 is anyway, her stepdad, Dave Stern. Dave is a big believer in the importance of knowing your numbers.
I'm a woodworker, and I build a variety of things, but mostly furniture-related, tables, bookcases, and I use math all the time in the shop. You can see this tabletop that I'm making. It's a commission I'm doing for a workbench for somebody. And what's important is that the tabletop be perfectly square. And the easiest way to see if something is square is to use the tape and measure the diagonals. And if they're exactly the same, then you know that that's a square table. If they're not the same, then what you have is a parallelogram. Okay, that diagonal is 69 3/16.
Dave was determined that Alex would learn these multiplication tables, and it turned into an epic battle of wills.
Basically got a set of flashcards with all the multiplication tables, and what we had to do, and it was you and I, would sit down and go through every single card in the multiplication table. And if you knew the answer, if you knew that 2 times 6 was 12, we didn't have to do it again. That would go in the discard pile. If you didn't know that 2 times 6 was 12, then that would go in the let's do it again pile.
And how did I handle that?
You were a little stubborn and grumpy and didn't, you know, kind of fought it, which was to be expected. But we were just sitting down and doing this, and you could fight and argue all you wanted, but we still had to go through the steps. And then eventually, two things happened. One was that you actually, by rote, began learning some of the multiplication table. The second thing was that pretty soon, because you were not only stubborn, you were very smart, and very soon you began to realize that the quicker you learn this multiplication table, the quicker we were going to be done with this very frustrating thing.
So I wouldn't have to sit there in the living room with you anymore.
Absolutely. And that was the goal. When you could go through the entire deck of flashcards and know everything without making a mistake, then we could stop doing the flashcards.
Yeah, I have like a little bit of a vivid memory of, and that I know that like I was always on the couch and you were always on the chair across from me.
That's right. It was kind of like two boxers keeping their distance from each other or something. Right.
That's Alex Stern talking to her stepdad, Dave Stern. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. We had help producing this week's show from Jen Kinney. Julian Harris is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.